Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hey everybody, this is Dr. John back with another episode of the Evolved Caveman. And I wanted to share with you, I had an amazing call with one of my clients this week. And to me, this is not just any client, but he happens to be one of the most brilliant and accomplished men that I've ever met. And we were talking about a lot of things, the default network, immersed self-talk, distanced self-talk. And one of the topics was egocentricity. Because I've been thinking a little bit about egocentrism, and I wanted to share a little bit about this. And let me just get through the technical stuff quickly here so we can get to the more relevant question of, so what? Why do I give a shit about egocentrism? Good question. Okay, so let me define it first. So a strict Merriam-Webster dictionary definition of egocentricity is the state of being self-centered or greater concern about the self than others to an excessive degree. And in Piaget's terms, the famous child psychologist, egocentrism is the inability to differentiate between self and other. More specifically, it's the inability to accurately assume or understand any perspective other than one's own. Now, there's more recent research that shows that although egocentric behaviors decline in adulthood, that there exists some forms of egocentrism even into adulthood, indicating that overcoming this may be a lifelong development that never achieves completion. So let me repeat that because this is really, really important. Overcoming egocentrism may be a lifelong challenge, a challenge that we never fully complete. So sure, adults appear to be less egocentric than little children because they're faster to correct from an initially egocentric perspective than kids, but not because they're less likely to initially come up with that egocentric perspective. So that really fits with what I found with a lot of adult clients that I've seen, you know, my 30-year career in psychology, that there's a lot of egocentrism out there. So, and even just, you know, let's get past that technical explanation. Just think about depressed people. Depressed people are largely egocentric in that they overfocus on their own misfortune, pain, and suffering. And that's part of why they're depressed, is because they can't break out of that habitual way of negative thinking. They're over-focused on self. And consider that anxious folks are over-focusing on how other people perceive them. They're often worried about other people negatively judging them. So again, an over-focus on self. So again, when it's taken to the extreme, it can lead to mental health issues. And it strikes me that I'm still egocentric at times. My fiance tends to remind me of this occasionally by saying, it's not always about you, baby. Really? It's not? Damn. So I want you to, without judgment, with great curiosity, simply consider the extent to which the situations, to which situations you tend to be more egocentric in. What situations, what context, with whom, at work, at home, with spouse, with parents, with kids, with friends. People that treat you badly, where do you tend to be more egocentric? Where do you think about yourself only or primarily? Because while you're thinking about that, here's one of the biggest areas that I see almost everybody being way too fucking egocentric, and it hurts us. Dramatic pause. One of the biggest mistakes we make is that we take the majority of what other people say, think, feel, and do personally. We're being too egocentric. And as a reminder, it's not all about you. And fortunately, this is a great thing. There's a story about the great spiritual teacher Gurdjieff many, many, many moons ago. And one day he asked his students, if a prisoner wants to escape from prison, what's the first thing he must know? The students thought for a bit, and one student answered, you have to know the layout of the prison to escape. Another said, it would be helpful to know where the key is, which guard had the key. No, said Gurdjieff. To escape prison, you must first know that you are in prison. Until you become aware of that, no escape is possible. Awareness is the first step. And so a lot of these things that I talk about, a lot of these ideas that I share are ways to escape your own mental self-limitations, your own damning, uncomfortable emotions. There are ways to get your mind and heart to work for you rather than against you. I wanted to, you know, entitle my second book, Stop Being Your Brain's Bitch. And everyone seems to have an intuitive grasp of that phrase. Like, oh, yeah, my mind fucks with me all the time. Yeah, I get that. My mom said, you know, you can't use that because you can't use the word bitch in the title. And I kind of laughed. I was like, Mom, I was just looking at the nonfiction titles, and three of the top 10 titles have the word fuck in them. One of which was by my friend Faith Harper. So one of the best things that I learned while in my PhD program at Cal was from, I think, one of the best teachers that I had there, Meiji Singh. A brilliant man, a Sikh Indian, very peaceful guy, very wise. Anyway, I was having a difficult conversation with a teacher at a school that I was working with, and I was consulting with her. And I forget exactly what she said to me, but it was something snarky and kind of, it was a put down. You know, kind of, what do you know? Because at the time I was like 25 and I didn't know much. But I came back to Meiji the next day and I kind of explained to him what was going on, and that, you know, the comment that she made hurt me. And he said, without missing a beat, he said, you know, John, most of us take 95% of what other people say, think, do, and feel personally, when in truth, only about 5% has anything to do with us. Only 5% has anything to do with us. Now think about how much of what other people say, think, feel, and do you're taking personally. As if you're some super fucking powerful, omnipresent, omniscient being that everyone else is concerned about. And I can give you a bunch of examples of this. I mean, the favorite one for me is, you know, you're working, you're at work. It's kind of an open office space, so there's a lot of cubicles. And the boss comes in from the elevator and he is noticeably annoyed. And you can tell from the scowl on his face, his jaw is set. He doesn't really say hi to anyone. He walks quickly into his office, slams the door, and just starts getting on his computer. So how do you interpret that? How do you interpret his seemingly angry behavior? I think most of us would think something like, oh shit, he knows I left work early on Thursday. Or, boy, he really didn't like that report I gave him yesterday. Or he wants to fire me. We tend to come up with these stories where we are at the center of the story. where what he's feeling is a direct result of something we did or didn't do. And here's what I tell clients a lot. Pick the interpretation that serves you the best. So sure, you might have that initial interpretation that's egocentric. The trick is coming up with a number of alternative explanations for why he might be in a bitchy mood that have nothing to do with you. For instance, maybe he's got a teenage son that came home wasted last night. Maybe the teenage son got arrested by the police. Maybe the teenage son got a girl pregnant. Maybe he got in an argument with his wife last night. Maybe he got a flat tire on the way to work. Maybe he got a ticket on the way to work. Maybe he's concerned about financial struggles with the company. I don't really care which interpretation you pick of those, but pick the one that serves you the best. Now, that leads into this book, Chatter, by Ethan Cross, which I think is brilliant. And I'm trying to get Ethan to come on the podcast. But one of the things that he talks about, and the book is Chatter, the book is all about the inner voice and, you know, why do we have it and how do we tame it, which I think is a really, really fantastic goal if you want to be happy. Because I think one of the biggest hurdles to our own happiness is the voice in our head, the inner critic, the fact that we believe most of the shit in our head. I don't believe most of the stuff in my head anymore because I know it's like a drunk monkey on crack, my mind. My mind is a random thought generating machine. Sometimes it spits out thoughts that are helpful. Sometimes it just spits out complete nonsense, utter bullshit. Like, I'm a fucking dumbass. My mind was telling me that after I had a PhD from Cal and had written a book. And I was still getting that thought. We know from, like if you put someone at the edge of the Grand Canyon and have them wait and pay attention to their thoughts, eventually at some point, most people's minds will, the inner critic will come out and say something like, jump. Why? That goes against everything about self-preservation and survival and Darwinism. It doesn't make any sense. Except for the fact that our mind tries to fuck with us at times. So stop being your brain's bitch. So here's a tool that'll help you with that. In this book, Chatter, Ethan talks about, he receives a death threat letter. And it just knocks him off his access for several days. Like he can't sleep. He can't focus at work. He's got intrusive images. And after the third night of not sleeping, he finds himself in the living room of his house, patrolling the downstairs with a baseball bat, I guess in order to protect his wife. And I think he has a young child at this point. And he hears himself say to himself, Ethan, what are you doing? And just the use of that third person, him calling himself by his own name, and the calmer tone of voice of the thought, which is funny because it's a thought, it doesn't really have tone of voice, but yet it does. It calmed him down. It allowed the rational mind, his rational mind, to come back online and think himself off the ledge. You know, got a good alarm system. Nobody ever really acts on these death threats. You know, it's just somebody that's pissed off and probably crazy. And then he was able to calm down enough to go back to bed and actually sleep. But it was his first awareness of getting out of this prison. And it made him think, why was that third person? Why was it so effective me calling myself by my first name? And he came up with this idea of immersed self-talk versus distanced self-talk. So immersed self-talk happens when we're using the first person, me, my, I. So just think about your own thoughts. And when you're speaking to yourself in the first person in your head, and think about the times where you've lost your shit emotionally, lost your temper, got really depressed, got really panicked, And see if you were thinking in the first person. See if you were immersed in your self-talk. Because if I look back at my stuff, that's definitely the case. And there's complete fusion between John, the entity, my mind, my thoughts, me. There's just no distinction. At that point, when I'm overcome by emotion, I am my thoughts. Now, the goal here is to try to increase psychological distance. So to take a step back and be able to observe yourself. And it's really the creation of metacognition or metacognitive skills, which is thinking about thinking, which is one of the fundamental leadership skills that good leaders must have. They have to be able to pull back and reflect on their own thoughts. They have to be able to manage their own emotions. And this is a key way that they do it. So we've known about psychological distance for many years, and there's tools that we would teach to create greater psychological distance. One of which is pretend you're a fly on the wall in the room in which you are, and you're looking at yourself from the fly's perspective. Simply a way to create greater psychological distance between yourself and your thoughts and your emotions. Another one, and I remember I had a client years ago that was really, really anxious. And I asked him to describe the anxiety. And he quite poetically, quite profoundly said, my anxiety is like being in a hurricane. I was like, whoa, I totally feel that. You know, shit swirling around you and bouncing off your head and you can't catch your breath because there's no air to be had. I said, okay, yeah, great description. And here's what I want you to do. Take a few steps so that you're in the eye of the hurricane. So now you've still got stuff swirling around you. There's still chaos, but at least now you can take a breath and you gain a few feet distance and you're safe in the eye of the hurricane. Now, once you've taken a couple breaths, I want you to go a step further and now pretend you're the weatherman commenting on the hurricane from a safe distance. So now you're 2 miles out of the hurricane, speaking in front of the camera, describing the hurricane. And if you want to go a step further, you can imagine yourself as the news anchor safely back in the TV studio talking to the weatherman about the hurricane. So it doesn't deny the hurricane. It doesn't say the hurricane doesn't exist. It's just giving you more and more steps of psychological distance. Now, here's the problem with these tools. They take up cognitive load, which means they require thought and they require working memory. So if we could come up with a tool to give you more psychological distance that did not take up cognitive load, that would be even more excellent, to quote Bill and Ted, I guess. And here's that tool that Ethan shares in his book. And it has to do with the first, second, and third person usage, those pronouns or calling yourself by your first name in your own head. So when you use that first person, me, my, I, you are immersed in your self-talk. There's no differentiation between self and your thoughts. And it does nothing. I mean, that's when you're at your most emotional. That's when you're at your worst, typically. One of the ways to shift out of that immediately is to remind yourself to use second person or third person. So I just go with third person now. I just use my first name. And it sounds something like, John, what are you thinking? Or, John, what's your best course of action here? Now, the interesting thing to me is, as you play around with this in your own head, these different pronouns and the thoughts connected to them have different tone of voice. So when I'm getting emotional and I'm thinking with me, my, I, if I'm getting anxious, that tone of voice feels more anxious. It has more anxious tone to it. If I'm getting depressed, it sounds like Eeyore. If I'm angry, it's angry. That voice, the thought in my head is more angry. It's really weird. Like, as I said, there's no voice, but yet there is. However, when I switch to that third person, when I switch to John, it immediately takes on the tone almost of a concerned caretaker or adult. And so I think of it as, you know, I do believe in, you know, the fact that there's multiple me's within me, multiple John. So there's like a five-year-old John in me, and he's often the one in the immersed self-talk, maybe throwing a tantrum because he doesn't get his way. There's a 15-year-old John in me that has a rebellious streak and can get angry and oppositional. And then there's the functional adult. So I like to think of that third person usage as the functional adult in my head, the one that is calm, rational, wise, perceptive, me at my best. So play around with this tool of first, second, third person, because to, again, bring it back to that conversation that I had at the beginning of this episode that I told you about. He said, you know, why didn't you tell me about this earlier? Like, this would have been the way to kind of unlock my intellectualization of everything. You know, I thought I was feeling, but really I was just intellectualizing everything. And I said, you know, it's a really difficult task to break through someone who is highly intelligent, to break through their defenses, the intellectual castle walls that they have built over decades to defend what it is they're doing and how they're doing it. And I don't always know the key. I just have a lot of tools that I can use to gradually tear the wall down. So I thought that was interesting. He thought this was quite big as well. And so going back to this idea of immersed voice versus distanced voice or distanced self-talk, one of the things they found in research is that a person who uses that first person singular pronouns, the I, me, my, a lot, highly indicative of depression. And even on Facebook, if you see people that use I, me, and my a lot, more likely they're in a depressed mood. As moving to that distanced self-talk using the second or third person. Oh, and second person is like pronouns he, she, they, her, just so you know. Studies show that distanced self-talk helps you make better first impressions, improves your cognitive performance under stress, probably because it calms you down. It aids wise reasoning, and it promotes rational thinking. It just seems to be a brain hack to help you switch perspectives instantly and gain greater psychological distance from any issue of dread or anger or sadness. And that psychological distance is everything. So bringing this full circle, circling back to the client again, I suppose, I got this beautiful text from him afterwards, and he said, on this note, thank you, John, for playing such a constructive role in other people's lives, including mine. I want you to know that you are highly cherished. You do something incredibly impactful in the lives of others. So thank you for being who you are and what you do. And that I did take personally, and I was quite moved. I feel very, very fortunate to do what I do. So for those of you who listen, thank you for listening. Thank you for your curiosity. Thank you for your courage in continuing to grow and push the envelope with me. Because without you, there's no me. Because in my mind, we're all interconnected. We are all interdependent. So I just wanted to say, thanks. I enjoy the hell out of what I do. I love learning. I love teaching. To me, there's nothing more important than learning these tools because it gives us the greatest shot at happiness. And of course, you know, happiness isn't going to be ever present. It's also about learning to surf the waves of emotions and thoughts and learning to radically accept when you are depressed, when you are angry, when you are panicked, so that you can get out of those states a little bit more quickly and you don't get stuck in those negative downward spirals of self-flagellation, beating yourself up. And yeah, so in closing, just thank you. It means a lot to me that you listen. I think that this is the way to improve ourselves as a species and perhaps save the planet. I do believe that if you want to save the world, you got to start with yourself. And I think that's all I have to say about that. If you like this stuff, please feel free to rate, review, share it with your friends, talk about it to others. I would appreciate that. I do think we need to get the word out. I think that, you know, the more people that have good emotional management skills, the better off the world is. The less angry people out there, the better off we all are. The less depressed people out there, the more productive our society is. So thank you for listening. Until next time, this is Dr. John. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.